Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
The In-Between is intended for mature audiences and may include topics that can be unsettling, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, rape, murder, and animal abuse. Testimony shared by guests of the show is their own and does not reflect the views of Mel Barrett, Ruby Grace Productions, or Grab Bag Collab. Listener discretion is advised.
Can we admit that we're all transfixed by that sick little soap opera trial in Exeter, New Hampshire?
What time did you get here today?
1:30 this morning.
1:30? Yeah. Why?
Wanted to get a front row seat, I guess.
If this story were a made-for-TV movie, and it surely will be, you might not believe it.
It is August 1st, 1990. Time is 10 a.m. Seabrook, New Hampshire. We're about to do a one-party consent via telephone.
Sat around brainstorming the pros and cons of slitting a man's throat rather than firing a .38 caliber projectile through his head.
Yes.
There's only one person in the state of New York who is sitting in prison tonight with a sentence of life with absolutely no possibility of parole.
Yes, I need a policeman. 4D, Misty Morning Drive.
Okay, what's going on over there, ma'am?
There's somebody screaming for help.
Has the jury reached a verdict on each of the three offenses charged?
Yes, we have.
On case number 90-1371, which charges the defendant with the crime of accomplice to first degree murder, how to say, is the defendant guilty or not guilty of the offense charged?
Guilty.
For 14 days in March of 1991, the country and much of the world was riveted by a court case in a tiny New Hampshire town called Exeter. The only reason anyone knew about this case is because it was the first ever gavel-to-gavel televised murder trial, and the 22-year-old woman standing trial for accomplice to murder, Pamela Smart, was a quote-unquote pretty ice princess who had seduced a 16-year-old student into killing her husband, Greg Smart. It was the guinea pig for OJ's trial and all the televised trials after it, but not many people remember it today. When I started this podcast, I assumed the Pamela Smart murder trial was as memorable as, say, Lorena Bobbitt, OJ, Scott Peterson, or the Menendez brothers. But I was wrong. In New Hampshire, where I was born, it's still in the vernacular, but outside it's more of a, oh, wasn't she the teacher who molested a student kind of vibe? So for those of you unfamiliar with the trial, welcome, friends. Grab a cup of coffee, tackle those dishes, fire up your car and take a road trip. We're going on a journey. Every moment of the trial was televised in New Hampshire on the local news. Some of us stayed home from school to watch on big days, like the day Bill Flynn, Cecilia Pierce, and of course Pam Smart testified. It played in every bar, restaurant, salon, department, and grocery store. News coverage before the trial began? That was also overwhelming. This is where I compare this case again to the Karen Reed trial that happened in Dedham, Massachusetts recently. As of this recording, there was a mistrial in the Reed case, with the DA saying he intends to retry her. I'm not in New England anymore, and what I'm hearing from my friends and family there is that you can't escape this story. But unlike Pam's defense, Karen has money, and her team is using every bit of press they can get to bring awareness to her case. And it's working. We're drawn to these two cases for the same reasons. Pamela Smart and Karen Reed. Both women are well-educated, attractive, outspoken, and they are standing up for themselves in the face of a New England state prosecuting them for murder in a small town that they both deny any involvement in, though they both accept responsibility that their actions leading up to the murder played a part in the outcome. The death of Pam's spouse, Greg Smart, and Karen's boyfriend, Boston police officer, John O'Keefe. When I think of the Pam Smart trial, I have fond-ish memories of my family gathering to watch it every day. If that sounds weird to hear, trust me, it feels a little weird to say. But it was exciting, like we used to gather to watch the Olympics. As I mentioned in episode 1, the commentary from my family and neighbors was wild. It's like they forgot, or maybe they didn't care that there were children in the room. Not just me, but neighbor kids and my younger cousins. We were watching and listening to everything the adults said and did. We heard them call her a slut. We heard them dwindle her existence down to her sexuality. We heard them say Pam Smart was a vindictive, money-grubbing woman who was only looking out for herself. We heard them call her a cold-blooded killer, a pedophile, and a psychopath. They spoke with such authority on the matter, I believed that they knew what they were talking about. There is a plethora of issues to choose from that make this trial shaky at best and appealable at worst, though Pamela Smart has lost every appeal she's filed. In fact, her first appeal, which dealt with issues with the judge, was heard by the very judge who presided over the murder trial, Judge Douglas Gray. He refused to recuse himself, denied he did anything improper, and denied Pam's appeal. Look, I know this isn't uncommon. First appeals go back to the original judge quite often, but it doesn't sit right with me. Of course the judge who oversaw the case is going to say he handled everything properly. Just like you listened to the prosecutor, Paul Maggiato, say he wouldn't do anything differently in the last episode. It just sounds like our justice system is self-police sometimes. Currently, post-conviction attorney Matt Zernheld from Zernheld Law is working on Pam's case, and he thinks he and his team can put together a strong new habeas appeal. I think of Matt as an independent post-conviction Captain America. When I speak with Matt, he's usually wrangling a toddler, a dog, and several post-conviction appeals. As per the Zernheld Law website, Matt has won in the appellate courts against adversaries such as the state's attorney for Baltimore City, the Maryland Office of the Attorney General, the Baltimore Police Department, the Baltimore City Law Department, and traditional corporate law firm adversaries. Matt is passionate about criminal law and believes everyone is entitled to each and every one of their constitutional rights. He holds the state and the justice system accountable at each and every stage of his client's criminal proceedings. Matt's also the co-founder of the Baltimore Action Legal Team, where he currently serves as the legal director. I spoke with Matt recently about some of the violations of Pam Smart's constitutional rights and why he thinks she has a good shot at appeal.
Every case is error. Finding an error in your trial is not hard, but you got to find an error that was so egregious or had such a substantial possibility that it probably had some effect, or we can likely see that it might have had some effect on the outcome of the trial.
Right.
And we need to show that this error had a substantial likelihood that it affected the outcome of your trial. If it didn't, you know, we can't really raise it. It's not a big enough issue. But if we can see that this had an outcome on your trial, then we can raise it. Where we're at now is we think we've found some meritorious issues that, you know, really might have had a big enough impact on Pam's trial that we can bring up.
You know, you've found things in the trial that you think are strong enough to appeal on that no one else has touched before.
Yeah, I think there's a mix of issues. I think we got some new evidence that shows what the jury relied upon was error, you know, not actual evidence that they should have been relying on. One of the big post-conviction issues that you will often see is ineffective assistance of counsel. That's not necessarily saying that counsel was bad. It's saying that a strong counsel might have made an error, and that was a particularly big error, and that's something that we are looking at, and we think it may have occurred here. And we're looking at some parts of trial that haven't been looked at, you know, under a particular light before.
So for this episode, and based on what I've been speaking to Matt about, I'm going to pick a handful of problems to go over, but I encourage you to read through the source material, watch the trial, and read the transcripts, which I'll post on my website, inbetweenpod.com. Matt and his small team have been working pro bono on Pam's case thus far. If you're so inclined, you can listen for details about how to help Matt's legal team at the end of this episode. I'll break down the issues with the trial just after this break.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Welcome back. Here's where we take a big old deep breath again. I'm about to hit you with a lot of information. So let's dig into the trial and errors, shall we? I think we can all agree, those of us who were there and those who watched from afar, there is no gray area, no in-between, about the media shitstorm this trial created. That's issue one. Should Judge Gray have approved a change of venue request? Exeter, New Hampshire is a tiny town. They were not ready for the frenzy that happened. Should Gray have limited media access? Pam and her team certainly thought so. He instead opened the doors and let the media flood in. During testimony, you can hear the incessant clicks of cameras going off all over the courtroom. The jury was uncomfortable with cameras in their faces as well. Here's Juror 13 again.
And I think that the circus of the media was ridiculous. About 10 billion cameras going off and everybody's taking billions of pictures. Which I think rots. I just think it rots.
And hey, there are solid arguments for having media present at trials. Hell, I'm benefiting from that presence some 34 years later. Cases that are off limits to journalists are all kinds of problematic. Journalists hold people in positions of authority, including prosecutors and judges, accountable. There's a reason we have the First Amendment. Also, hey, Supreme and federal courts, we'd like a word. I, and I'm sure every other journalist out there, would really like more access to your hearings. But having a free press doesn't mean that media coverage of a case has to be all Wild Wild West. And this one was. Local television station WMUR halted all of their regular programming and aired the trial gavel to gavel every day starting at 9 a.m. Local New Hampshire and Boston newspapers covered it daily well before the trial began. Talk shows did too, with headlines like, "Fatal Marriages When Marriage Turns to Murder." The National Enquirer loved the Pam Smart story and ran headlines like, "The Teacher Gets Detention, a Steamy Murder Trial Bewitches a Small Town," and "Teacher Gave Pupils Lessons in Murder." And my personal favorite, "Vicious Revenge, Pamela Smart, Killer Teacher Sent Lesbian Lover After Mother-in-Law, Seductive Black Widow Tormented Dead Husband's Family from Behind Bars." I'll have more on the National Enquirer and their legal troubles in reference to Pam Smart in a later episode, but put a pin in it for now. They were a big player in this media frenzy before and after Pam was incarcerated. 2 days before the trial began, WMUR released a movie created by local reporter Bill Spencer, who seemed to have a lot of access to police, the Smarts, the kids involved in the case, and Pamela herself. The movie, considered a documentary by some, was titled Anatomy of a Murder. In Anatomy of a Murder, Bill Spencer proclaims Pamela Smart's guilt. I repeat, Bill Spencer, a local news reporter, proclaimed Pam's guilt 2 days before the trial. You can't unring that bell, folks. Imagine if you were heading to trial, accused of murder, and your local news station was telling the world you're guilty before the jury is even seated in the courtroom. On top of that, imagine how confused some of the jury pool might have been by the news stories that were printed daily in the local and regional papers. In fact, one juror, whom I'll cover more in depth a little later on, in a post-trial interview with a reporter for Justice Magazine, claimed she voted to convict Pamela Smart because Bill Flynn cried on the stand and because Pam Smart tried to take a hit out on Cecilia Pierce. Why is this important? Because it never happened in the trial. The Boston Globe and local papers like the Union Leader published a story based on hearsay, and this juror read that story and voted to convict, thinking the story was fact. Seriously, there's a lot more on this story. I did a lot of digging to find the reporter who did this interview, and well, it's interesting to say the least. Jury misconduct to say the most. Back to Bill Spencer. He loved the spotlight so much he ended up playing himself in a narrative film starring Helen Hunt, released just after the trial, called Murder in New Hampshire. Here's Bill's big moment.
Can you move that mic up just a little bit, Jim? Just a little bit closer to her face, you know, so we can hear what she has to say.
You're wondering about the dress, right? Grant gave me this dress. He loved it.
Don't worry about that. You look absolutely beautiful. I mean, you're holding up remarkably well. I can't believe how well you're doing. I really don't know how you do it. Listen, Pam, let me ask you just one more thing off the record. I'm not going to use this, but why did you happen to call me? I mean, of all the people you could have called.
Oh, you're my favorite newscaster. I watch your reports all the time, and I know what goes into it. Believe me.
Thank you.
We should talk sometime also about the business.
We'll do that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Cringe, right? Ugh. The Boston Globe created a 1-800 number anyone could call to submit a response to their poll about Pam's guilt. Paul Maggiato, the lead prosecutor, said that never happened, but he lied or he was wrong. You be the judge.
Most of what was in the press and most of what was in the TV are just replays of what happened during the day in the courtroom. So there was no polls going on. We think she's guilty. We think she's not guilty. You know, call in how many people think she's guilty. I mean, there was none of that.
Do you believe Pamela Smart was involved in the plot to kill her husband? So yes, press one.
The issue of the media circus was raised by the defense, but Judge Gray denied a change of venue and refused to sequester the jury until the second day of deliberations, and after threatening that he would sequester them for the holiday weekend if they didn't come up with a verdict. Here's Mark Sisti, part of Pam's original defense team, discussing Gray's denial.
Well, I'm pretty sure that if we had Pam's case today, we'd have a completely different look at the control of what was going on with regard to the media, okay? There's no question about it. It would have been much more restrained. There would have been maybe one dedicated camera. There wouldn't have been this mass out there influencing, witnesses as they came and went from the courthouse. I think that judges in the state today would have entertained venue changes and sequestration of the jury. Mm-hmm. These are things that Judge Gray denied. We requested venue changes prior to trial. We requested sequestration on a number of occasions during the trial, and he only granted sequestration once it just became uncontrollable during deliberations. And gave us only one day, I think, day and a half of sequestration. Mm. It's clear it wasn't impossible to do because it was done.
Right.
We had done it. I had done sequestration in major murder cases in the state prior to that. It's not like a unicorn or something.
Right.
We've had juries sequestered during a capital case and juries sequestered during a first-degree murder case in the past. Not rare. Not unmanageable, and it rendered fair verdicts in both.
The media always plays a big part in trials these days, but back then, it was unheard of to air a trial gavel to gavel on the local and national news. Plenty of Pam Smart's defenders feel that on those grounds alone, she had a good argument for appeal. As I mentioned a few moments ago, the media certainly got into the head of Juror 13. Let's talk about how else the jury was affected, or how they affected this case. What happens when a jury isn't sequestered, like the Pam Smart jury? According to Judge Audrey G. Fleissig, chair of the Committee on Court Administration and Case Management, quote, jurors must decide a case solely on the evidence and law presented to them in the courtroom. In a world where social media can overwhelm us with information and misinformation, it's important to remind jurors again and again not to be distracted from their civic duty, end quote. Now, Fleissig is referencing modern technology that didn't exist back in the 90s, but juries have been instructed in basically the same manner for decades. Here's Judge Beverly Cannoni from the Karen Reed trial giving the jury instructions on absorbing information about the case outside of court.
Okay, so please do not discuss this case with anyone. Don't do any independent research or investigation into the case. If you happen to see, hear, or read anything about the case, please disregard it and let us know. So we'll see you tomorrow.
Jurors, closing your notebooks and leaving them on the chairs. Gather your belongings. Follow me. All right, jury up, please.
And just for color, here's Gray's instructions to the Pam Smart jury.
Ladies and gentlemen, please leave your notebooks in your seats. The bailiff will pick them up. I assure you no one else will read them, and they'll be on your seats tomorrow morning, and at the end of this trial, your notes will be destroyed. Just leave them in your seats for now. Have a nice evening. Please don't discuss this case, and we'll see you tomorrow morning at 9:30. Thank you.
All right.
So, we're to understand a few things from these instructions. A, jurors shouldn't read, speak about, or listen to anyone outside of the court about the case. B, jurors shouldn't do their own independent research about the case. And C, jurors must leave their notebooks on their seats. No one will read them, and at the end of the case, their notes will be destroyed. Pretty straightforward instructions. How difficult are they to follow? Let's find out. In the Pam Smart accomplice to murder trial, there were three recorded instances of juror misconduct. What do you think of when you hear juror misconduct? It's not that jurors were dancing on tables or getting blitzed in the jury deliberation room, though honestly, that's where my mind goes. Nope. These misconduct allegations had more to do with locals who had been seated on the jury talking about the case and their opinions in public, or as I alluded to above, reading and or watching media about the case and letting news stories dictate their vote. That's a straight up no-no. It's in the rules. It's been in the rules as long as jury rules have existed. The first instance of reported juror misconduct happened when Brian Adams... No, not the summer of 69, Brian Adams. Brian Adams, the juror who just happened to have graduated from Winnicunnet High School, where the teens involved in the plot went to school, was caught discussing the case during the trial at a local bar. Linda Wojcis, Pam's mom, received an anonymous phone call at 10:20 p.m. during the trial. She answered and a man told her there was a juror at the bar discussing the case with other patrons. He gave Linda Brian Adams' name and hung up. Linda reported the call. Pam's defense requested the wiretap of the Wojcicki's phone. Why was there a wiretap, you ask? Well, because the Wojcicki's felt they needed to record all calls coming into their home because they'd received so many death threats over Pam's trial. Here's the rub, though. Sisti and Toomey, Pam's lawyers, were told by the state police that Linda hadn't received a call at 10:20 p.m. when Linda said she received the call. Next, Judge Gray questioned Adams, but decided Adams had done nothing wrong, and Gray took no further action. It was later revealed, after the trial, that the state police had mistakenly checked the call log for 10:20 a.m. instead of 10:20 p.m. When the log was checked again, there it was, the call at 10:20 p.m., just like Linda Wojcicki's reported. According to Pam Smart's defense team, the second instance of juror misconduct happened in the jury room before the trial even started and continued throughout. Charlotte Jeffs, the oldest member of the jury at 75 years, prejudiced the jury by repeatedly calling Pam guilty and talking about her quote-unquote wickedness. These allegations are outlined in Pam's 2018 petition for commutation. According to an affidavit from Robert Arosa, who was a potential juror, Ms. Jeffs said, quote, "I hope she hangs," end quote, among other statements. Charlotte Jeffs is also the juror who said she voted to convict based on the hearsay the Boston Globe and Union Leader reported about Pam trying to take a hit out on Cecilia Pierce. I came across the transcript of this interview when going through the case files that Pam's mom has been storing for 34 years. In the early 2000s, a reporter for now-defunct Justice magazine, who asked that I not use her name on this podcast, though they did verify their handwriting and the microcassette that was used to record the interview, contacted Charlotte Jeffs and interviewed her about the Pam Smart trial and why she chose to convict. During the interview, Charlotte Jeffs claimed several times that she convicted because Pam Smart tried to take a hit out on Cecilia Pierce, something that was never brought up in trial. Charlotte Jeffs, sadly, is no longer with us, so here's an actor reenacting the exchanges from the interview.
It was 12 guilty. There was no way she was possibly getting out of this. She thought nothing of murdering anybody. And when she was in jail awaiting trial, she had a friend there whose husband agreed to kill one of the girls who was testifying against her.
Which girl was she trying to kill?
I can't think of her name, but she went to see her in jail.
According to Pam Smart and her mother, Linda Wojcicki, Linda was contacted right after the interview by the unnamed reporter. The reporter was shaken by what she'd heard from Jeffs and thought Linda should know about it so that she could inform Pam Smart's lawyers of the juror misconduct. Linda requested that the reporter send her a transcript of the interview, which the reporter did, and Linda gave it to Mark Sisti and Pam's appellate attorney, Al Johnson. According to Linda and Pam, the lawyers did nothing with the information, so it's been sitting boxed for 20-plus years. And until now, no one's ever heard this story. Charlotte Jeffs was also questioned in this interview about any media she had done, and Ms. Jeffs claimed she had done no media before, during, or after the trial, but that was a lie. In an article for the LA Times on March 24, 1991, Charlotte Jeffs said, quote, "The tapes, they told the truth," end quote. In an article for the Boston Globe on March 21, 1991, Jeffs said, quote, "I knew a little bit about the case before it started. I was out in California when the murder happened, and I saw it on TV. I think everybody did," end quote. According to this same article, Judge Gray allowed folks onto the jury who had seen and heard about the case, but had not formed an opinion. Sure, Jan. The third and perhaps most famous of the juror misconduct stories involves someone we've covered in this and previous episodes of The In-Between. Juror 13, Karen Sicard. Sicard recorded herself at home after trial, discussing each day's events. During the recordings, which it sounds like she usually did from a bubble bath every night, Sicard can be heard speaking with other people in her household, more than likely her teenage daughter, while recording. I'm thinking if I can hear her daughter and whomever else was in the house at the time, her daughter can probably hear Karen. Just going out on a limb here. Sicard faced serious legal issues when Pam's lawyer during the appeal accused her of trying to sell the tapes she made during the trial to his office. Sicard's friends, Keith and Diane Hamm, also supplied affidavits to the defense stating that Sicard was actively searching for a buyer of the tapes. It was also reported in a Portsmouth Herald article, the court documents claim Sicard was accused of speaking with Keith Hamm on the first night of deliberations at a local market basket. I'm going to say this so the locals recognize it. Market Basket. Market Basket is a well-known grocery store chain in New England. It's where my family and I used to get our best gossip, too. When Gray was reprimanding or questioning the jurors about misconduct, Pam's defense was not allowed to be present, and during voir dire, most of the jurors acknowledged that they had been exposed to pretrial publicity and had learned of the facts about the case from the media. One potential juror stated before the trial began that in the jury pool room, a general consensus developed that Pam Smart was guilty. A fourth incident occurred after the trial, when juror Alec Beckett was paid to write an article for the Boston Globe about his experiences as a juror on the Pamela Smart accomplice to murder trial. In the article, Beckett claims that on the first day of deliberations, three jurors wanted to vote guilty and three, quote, had far too many doubts to even contemplate guilty, end quote. And that, quote, that was where we stood at 5 p.m. last Wednesday when the judge came in and told us that we would be sequestered the next night if we hadn't come to a verdict, end quote. Beckett also claimed the jury didn't deliberate and voted right away, unanimously guilty, of the witness tampering charge because, quote, the defense attorney in his closing statement had basically confessed for Pam to witness tampering, and the evidence on the tape was clearly undeniable, end quote. I'm not sure about you, but I know for sure defense attorneys aren't supposed to claim their clients are guilty, especially when they're pleading not guilty. But both Toomey and Sisti have done it. Here's Mark Sisti as recently as June of this year on ABC News.
She honestly was involved right up to her neck in the murder of Greg. And she willingly and honestly has confronted that and has admitted that.
We'll get into this a bit more later in the episode, but for now, let's go back to sequestration. Judge Gray refused to sequester the jury until the second day of deliberations, despite the defense team's protestations. In the defense team's opinion, it was too late. The jury had been tainted, and it seemed like Gray was trying to squeeze the toothpaste back into the tube at the last possible minute. On Good Friday, Gray interrupted deliberations and warned the jury that they should bring their toothbrushes and promised that if they did not come up with a verdict by 5 p.m., they would be sequestered going into Easter weekend. At the time Judge Gray spoke to the jury, the preliminary vote for guilt was 3, for not guilty 3, and 6 undecided. Again, we know this because Juror Beckett wrote about it in the Boston Globe post-trial. Shortly after Gray's warning about coming up with the verdict and being sequestered the next day, the jury deliberated for 4 more hours and came to their guilty verdict. I reached out to Alec Beckett and asked to interview him, and this is the response I received via email.
Not interested. Thanks, Alec.
It's unfortunate because Alec has done interviews for the documentary Captivated and Diane Sawyer, and he wrote that article for the Boston Globe, so I was hoping that he would speak with me as well, and I wish he would reconsider. Okay, we've tackled the media, the jury, and mostly how Gray handled his court. We've also covered in previous episodes the fact that the prosecutors admitted into evidence the unauthenticated, barely audible wiretaps between Cecilia Pierce and Pamela Smart. The wiretaps were then transcribed by a quote-unquote secretary, again, Maggiato's word, not mine, and the transcripts were given to the jury during deliberations even though they were not in evidence. This one right here still sort of blows my mind. They were not evidence, rather a tool to help understand what was on the tapes, though the assistant in Maggiato's office was not a certified transcriber. A few years after the trial, Diane Sawyer interviewed Pamela Smart in prison, and as part of their story, ABC hired audio forensics expert Steve Kane of AFTI Steve Kane & Associates to analyze the wire and phone taps. I have a copy of Steve's report and will post it under source material on the inbetweenpod.com. But as of this recording, have not been able to find Steve Kane to ask him his thoughts on the wiretaps. I've called every number and emailed every email I can find. I even went as far as to contact Dr. Michael Schall, PhD, who appears to have been an advisor to Steve Kane on this report, and received this email in response to my request to speak to Dr. Schall for the podcast.
Mr. Barrett, as far as I know, Mr. Kane has not been in forensic practice for many years. Our last contact was more than a decade ago. I have no knowledge of the case you mentioned, nor of his report in that matter. I decline pro bono work. Best wishes, Michael Chial, PhD.
So for now, I only have the report that Steve Kane did for ABC. What I saw in the report stunned me. Let's take a quick break before we dive into the Kane report.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Q1, tape 9, side A, 4:14 seconds. Audio ends on. Leader on side A with Pierce in middle of conversation. Q1, tape 9, side B, 2 seconds. Start of audio within ongoing conversation. Smart. Portion of audio apparently removed from end side A to beginning of side B. Q2, side A, 5 seconds. Lack of normal start mark of original recorder, 24 seconds. Lack of stop, restart of recorder between announcement and start of target conversation, 26 seconds. Interruption, pause, of ongoing conversation, 74 seconds. Suspicious breaks during ongoing conversation.
That's a reenactment of parts of Steve Kane's report on the wiretaps. Steve gave a detailed sampling of, quote, some of the more troublesome anomalies, end quote, found on the tapes. And I desperately want to speak with Steve Kane. So, Steve, if you're out there and listening, please get in touch. Your analysis could be crucial in unlocking one of the mysteries of this case. One of the other issues with Judge Gray's court and decisions came into play when he was making a ruling about the defense's request to recall witnesses to the stand. I've delved into what Gray termed, quote unquote, jailhouse bravado in episode 3, but here's a recap. Bill Flynn and J.R. Latimy were writing letters from jail to friends, girlfriends, and family. Some of their letters were turned over to the defense. To refresh your memory, here's my friend Todd reading Bill Flynn's letters.
When we were arrested, as you know, we were kids, which meant the state had to spend over 6 months to certify us. While Pam was an adult, she'd just got a trial date, which means she could go to trial long before us, leaving her the option that if she was found guilty to testify against us for a lesser charge. You see, she had already told people that if she was found guilty, she would testify against us. Now with Raymond, we owe him. He already testified against us. We're going to return the favor.
And here's another.
All the jurors have been picked, I guess. Bunch of bullshitting assholes, if you ask me. Pam's lawyers have filed a motion to not let us testify. I pray to God they get it. I hate myself for having to do this, but I just don't have a choice. I'll never forget the day they told me she said she'd testify against us if she got convicted. The attorney general's afraid I'll get on the stand and say she's innocent.
And for good measure, here's a letter from JR to his girlfriend, Michelle Nichols.
This place I'm in is very, very boring, and there is a bunch of fags here. Not gay fags, but fags. I have a question. Were you surprised when you found out I got arrested? When I first got here, I got a 24-hour restriction in my room because me, Pete, and Bill are not allowed to talk, look at, or sit next to each other.
When Sisti and Toomey asked to be permitted to recall Bill and JR to the stand to question them based on the contents of the letters they wrote, Judge Gray denied them. In his argument, Sisti told the court the letters contain references to the witnesses' decisions to plead guilty and testify against Pam Smart, their interest in getting attention from the media, Bill threatening other inmates, as well as referring to the jurors as, quote-unquote, a bunch of bullshitting assholes. Gray denied them. Go figure. This leads me to another issue with the trial, one that seems relevant today, again, because of what happened with Karen Reed, Judge Gray's jury instructions and his, quote-unquote, mandate on sentencing. Let's talk about jury instructions first, and then we'll get to the rather complicated subject of Gray's, quote-unquote, mandate. As some of you know from watching live trials by jury, usually the prosecution lays out their case in chief first. The defense is allowed to cross-examine the prosecution's witnesses. Then when the prosecution rests, the defense gets their shot to call witnesses, whom the prosecution can then cross-examine. Closing arguments come from both sides, and once both sides rest, the case gets kicked to the jury for deliberation and hopefully a verdict. Before this happens, the judge must instruct the jury on the law and how they should determine if a defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt or not guilty, based on the legal principles and standards of the jurisdiction, also based on the charges. The jury instructions can be lengthy. Judge Gray's instructions took nearly 45 minutes to read. He made sure to remind the jury that Pam Smart was not being charged with first-degree murder, that she was, in fact, being charged with accomplice to first-degree murder.
The defendant is charged with being an accomplice to first-degree murder. To prove that the defendant was an accomplice to the crime of first-degree murder, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime of first-degree murder took place and that the defendant was an accomplice. This defendant is not charged with first-degree murder. And so in this charge, I have used the term actor, which means, in this case, William Flynn. William Flynn, as you know, has not pled guilty to first-degree murder. The state must prove that this defendant was an accomplice to the crime of first-degree murder. To prove the defendant was an accomplice, the state must prove, first, that the defendant helped another person plan or commit the crime of first-degree murder. And secondly, that the defendant did so with the purpose of promoting or facilitating the commission of the offense. Thus, the defendant is only guilty as an accomplice if she committed acts which were designed to commit a crime that both she and the principal, William Flynn, intended to commit.
You may want to listen to that again. Pam Smart was not being charged with first-degree murder, and she is only guilty as an accomplice if she committed acts which were designed to commit a crime that both she and the principal, Bill Flynn, committed. Are you going, okay, Mel, what the frig is your point? Here it is. Pam Smart didn't murder Greg Smart. Bill Flynn allegedly did. So did she and Bill commit the same crime? See, Bill had been charged with first-degree murder, but he wasn't convicted of it. He didn't even go to trial on it. Instead, he pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of second-degree murder. But Pam was charged with being an accomplice to first-degree murder. So for her to get convicted of that, the lawyers in her trial had to prove that Bill was guilty of first-degree, even though he'd never been convicted of first-degree. No jury ever saw the evidence against him at all, period. Matt Zernhelt explained to me when you're pushing accomplice liability theory, you have to establish all elements of first-degree murder and you have to prove that the accused actually took part in the murder. The defendant has to have the same mental culpability as the principal. How could they say Pam was guilty of being an accomplice to first-degree murder when no one was ever convicted of committing first-degree murder? So Judge Gray says he has a quote-unquote mandate during the immediate sentencing after the jury came back with their guilty verdict. Listen to his words.
Pamela Smart, on indictment number 1371, charging you with the offense of accomplice to first-degree murder, on the jury's verdict of guilty and in accordance with the mandates of our state legislature, I am required and do hereby sentence you to the New Hampshire State Prison for Women for the remainder of your life without the possibility of parole.
In accordance with the mandates, I am required. As I mentioned in episode 6 in my interview with Prosecutor Maggiato, there is no mandate in the state of New Hampshire for accomplice to first-degree murder, though Maggiato claims there is. In the statute that Maggiato cited to me,
RSA 630.1A3rd, a person is guilty of murder in the first degree if he, A, purposely causes the death of another, and a person convicted of a murder in the first degree shall be sentenced to life imprisonment and shall not be eligible for parole at any time.
So let me just remind you that Judge Gray made a point to caution the jury that Pam Smart was not being charged with first-degree murder. And let's not forget what Juror 13, Karen Sicard, said about the sentencing. I'll read it back to you. I had no idea, and I'm not the only one, because the judge came in and said his terms, mandatory in the state of New Hampshire, life in prison with no parole. And I'm telling you, not a dry eye in that jury room, and that's the God's honest truth. Even the ones who were like arguing adamantly that she's guilty. I mean, there were three of us who argued adamantly that she wasn't, and I was one of them. But life with no parole, she, you know, that's forever. That's not fair. Juror 13 may have been right. It wasn't fair. It also doesn't appear to be mandated. Imagine if you had been convicted of accomplice to first degree murder and you had a judge telling you he's mandated to sentence you to life without parole and no one, not your lawyers, not the judge, not the prosecutors, tells you there's no actual mandate and you spend 34 years of a sentence getting denied commutation and parole hearings and appeals only to find out this might have been solved and a lesser sentence could have been implemented in 1991 if someone representing you or looking out for you had known the law. Unfortunately, in our criminal justice system, scenarios like this happen all the time. Let that sink in while we take a break. I touched on this last piece of the trial a bit earlier, but I think it's worth digging into even deeper. If you are charged with a crime, your attorney cannot say you are guilty in court if you have pleaded not guilty. This is a violation of your right to a fair trial. It could also be considered unethical conduct by the lawyer, as it would essentially be admitting guilt on your behalf without your consent. This isn't something that many people may have caught when it happened, even though the jury, the judge, the press, the entire courtroom, and everyone watching on WMUR's live coverage of the trial heard it with their own ears. I touched on it earlier in this episode when I played a clip of Pam Smart's attorney, Mark Sisti, telling ABC News that she was, quote, in it up to her neck, end quote. But he wasn't saying that to a jury. His co-counsel during the murder trial, Paul Toomey, did tell that to the jury, however. Pamela Smart's defense attorney, Paul Toomey, told the jury that she was guilty, not of murder, but one of the lesser charges, witness tampering. If you haven't heard it, listen. Here's part of Toomey's closing arguments to the jury.
She's clearly engaging in acts that constitute witness tampering. Okay? And this, no, the act she does, she tries to get Cecilia to lie to the police. No doubt about it. Or to withhold information for a single doubt about it.
And again, just to hammer the point home, he says,
but sometimes there are circumstances where someone does acts that you look at them and that actually constitute a crime. And she does, those acts she does with serious gears, in a vacuum is witness tampering.
On that witness tampering, I'm telling you two things. I'm telling you that the acts are there, that you did them all, and that you shouldn't find a case because of the factors and what was going on in her mind. snap. I want you to listen to those tapes.
When he's encouraging the jury to listen to the tapes, he's also asking that they read the transcripts that go along with them, even though the transcripts, as I've covered in depth, were created by an assistant in the DA's office who was not a certified transcriber and whom Maggiato has never been able to name. And the transcripts are inconsistent with what's on the wiretaps. I'll again ask, why didn't Pam's lawyers raise these questions pre-trial in the suppression hearing? Was it because, as Sissy stated to me previously,
I'm not going to sit back here and say that it was overwhelming evidence, but it was certainly sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. The tapes that did come in, mm-hmm. I'll be quite frank, were damning. They were not good, all right? And they, unfortunately, were the words coming out of my client's mouth. And they weren't subtle, they weren't kind, and they certainly were not words that would exonerate her.
But the issue with this statement is that it's factually incorrect. The words and the tapes don't match. Were Sisti and Toomey so defeated by what Maggiato and the AG's office were selling as a 1-2 punch of the tapes and the transcripts that they didn't even try to defend their client against them? Were they defeated before they even began? Why do I bring this up? Because of the Supreme Court case number 16-8255, McCoy versus Louisiana. I'll give you the Cliff Notes version of this case. Robert McCoy was accused of killing his estranged wife's family members in 2008. He was convicted of 3 counts of first-degree murder in 2011. But during the trial, against his wishes, McCoy's lawyer, Larry English, conceded McCoy's guilt. Larry English believed telling the jury his client was guilty would save him from the death penalty. But the jury was like, "Ah, hell no." And then they went ahead and imposed the death penalty on all 3 counts. McCoy first appealed to the Louisiana Supreme Court and was denied. Next, he went to the United States Supreme Court, and may she rest, Our Lady of Liberty and Justice, Miss Ruth Bader Ginsburg, wrote an opinion in McCoy's favor, holding the Sixth Amendment guarantees a defendant the right to choose the objective of their defense and to insist that their counsel not admit guilt. So, Batty Ginsburg stated in her opinion, quote, "We hold that a defendant has the right to insist that counsel refrain from admitting guilt, even when counsel's experience-based view is that confessing guilt offers the defendant the best chance to avoid the death penalty. Guaranteeing a defendant the right to, quote, have the assistance of counsel for his defense, end quote, the Sixth Amendment so demands. With individual liberty and, in capital cases, life at stake, it is the defendant's prerogative, not counsel's, to decide on the objective of his defense, to admit guilt in the hopes of gaining mercy at the sentencing stage, or to maintain his innocence, leaving it to the state to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt." End quote. So saith she. This is something new to me about this trial. I heard what Toomey said just like the rest of y'all, and it went over my head, but then I started thinking about it. Why was he claiming she was guilty? Was it to give the jury a charge, the witness tampering charge, to hang their hats on? To me, when I watched the closing over and over again, I found Toomey's tone, his general demeanor, and his cavalier style of throwing his own client under the bus when she had clearly stated she's not guilty and pled that in court really unsettling. Not to mention the amount of times he claimed Pam Smart quote-unquote snapped. She's just an overly emotional woman, I guess. And don't you forget it. To make matters even more complicated, nearly a year later, in a case called Anaya versus New Hampshire, the State Supreme Court of New Hampshire declared that cases, quote, in which the defendant's attorney tells the jury the defendant is guilty of the charged offense, end quote, tend to be viewed by reviewing courts as, quote, warranting automatic reversal, end quote. In this case, the defendant, Anthony Anaya, was convicted of accomplice to second-degree murder. His attorney, thinking the jury would convict his client of first-degree murder, told the jury he was guilty in order to hopefully get his client a lesser sentence. Anaya appealed, and it went to the Supreme Court. The court ruled in favor of Anaya. Anaya's lawyer, who argued that an attorney cannot tell the jury their client is guilty if the defendant says they're not guilty during the appeal, Paul Toomey, who was guilty of telling the jury that his own client was guilty just a year earlier. He told the jury Pam Smart was guilty, and it worked. The jury didn't even deliberate when they voted unanimously on day one that Pam Smart was guilty of witness tampering. Make it make sense, y'all. As I mentioned earlier in the episode, Matt Zernheld and his small law office are working pro bono on the case so far. But a group of Pam Smart supporters have created a pay-to-it legal defense fund to help with the big cost of investigating, researching, and filing an appeal in Pam's case. If you feel so inclined, you can go to paytoit.com. That's pay, the number 2, it.com, and search Pamela Smart. They're trying to raise $75,000 so Matt can pay his legal aides and experts, so I'm sure every little bit helps. There's more to this Sixth Amendment violation coming in future episodes, something currently happening that I can't discuss yet until it's fully analyzed and vetted. But I'm telling you, it's really messed up. And I intend to figure out what the hell is going on. Next time on The In-Between.
The ultimate mission: sell the most papers of anybody in the world.
It's the most perfectly placed piece of propaganda in America. The most powerful people change the news narrative at will.
Look at the Inquirer in the realm of popular culture rather than journalism.
Get the story and don't come back until you have it.
We paid sources? Yes, we do. The JonBenet story.
Schwarzenegger.
Michael Jackson.
Princess Diana.
Cosby.
Oprah sold a lot of papers.
This is the stuff that tabloid dreams are made of.
If we had had George Bush doing blow, we would have done it.
Let's be honest, the media is a double-edged sword, and we've all seen what disinformation can do to folks who don't fact-check, or who begin with confirmation bias.
Pamela told this 16-year-old girl many incriminating things.
Did you hear the tape, Mr. Spencer? Did you hear it?
No, of course I didn't.
And you've made a judgment on my daughter based on not hearing that tape?
Well, she was starting to control all the prisoners because she was the infamous Pamela Smott, and she was using her sex again with the guards and with the prisoners. And she was caught on multiple occasions.
He came in one time, and then 2 days later he came back. And he said that he didn't want to lose his job in case she told, so he needed some extra insurance, and he took pictures of her. He demanded first that she strip naked, and she refused to do that. She thought actually he was coming back to rape her. And she finally talked him out of that part of it, but agreed to pose in some lingerie. Well, the National Enquirer got those pictures from the girlfriend of the guard who was the rapist.
From Pam's family side of things, the prison was growing frustrated with the supporters. That frustration, Linda Wojcicki believes, is what caused a several hours long disappearance of their daughter. The In-Between is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett. I also do some of the audio editing, but I couldn't content edit this sucker without the amazing Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Amber Hunt, my editor. Amber keeps me on track and helps cut the bullshit. Thanks, Amber. Thanks as well to my research partner and cousin-in-law, Lacey Umble. I also couldn't get this done without the kick-ass team at Grabbag Collab, Amber Hunt, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan. The In-Between wouldn't exist without the encouragement and support of my dear friend, fellow podcaster, and all-around rock star, Yellen Marie Marsh. I love you, Ellen. Thanks for all you do. And I want to send another shout out to Rebecca Lavoie over at Crime Writers On, who gave me my first feedback on the series and encouraged me to pitch it. Thanks, Rebecca. Finally, my love, my partner, Lindsay, your support and belief in me always keeps me moving forward, even when the way ahead is very dark. Thanks for doing this with me. Also, your reenactments are my favorite. If you want to dive deeper into the cases I cover, visit inbetweenpod.com for source material and updates. You can find all the episodes and bonus content of The In-Between on the Grabbag Collab main Patreon feed. Until the next time, be good people and don't do murder.